This is the Quality News Network. The number two ranking Republican senator plans to step down. Senator Trent Lott of Mississippi will resign by the end of the year, but is not exactly saying why. With 5 years to go in his current term, his powerful position on Capitol Hill could go to one of several colleagues, including John Kyle of Arizona or Lamar Alexander of Tennessee. President Bush greeted former Vice President Al Gore to the Oval Office for a private meeting and the traditional photo with the American 2007 Nobel Award winner. Also at tonight's state dinner, Mr. and Mrs. Bush will host diplomatic representatives from more than 40 countries who will attend tomorrow's Middle Eastern Peace Conference in Annapolis, Maryland. Mr. Bush also signed a deal setting the foundation for a potential long-term U.S. troop presence in Iraq, with a round of details still to be negotiated. Iraq would gain full responsibility for internal security, and U.S. troops would be relocated to bases outside the cities. Iraqi officials foresee a long-term presence of around 50,000 troops. That's down from the current figure of more than 160,000. Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton is now running behind the top five Republican presidential contenders in general election matchups. That's according to a new poll. Senator Barack Obama and former Senator John Edwards both hold narrow leads over those same GOP contenders. Twin suicide bombings in Pakistan killed more than 20 policemen, ratcheting up pressure on President General Musharraf. 40 people were wounded, many of them critically. Vice President Dick Cheney has an irregular heartbeat, according to his doctors. The abnormality discovered today during a routine doctor's visit. He's undergoing further medical evaluation and will require moderate outpatient treatment. A powerful typhoon has slammed into northeastern Philippines, flooding 50 villages and killing at least 10 people. Two moderate earthquakes hit central Indonesia. That was over Sunday night. Early reports show 3 are dead, 45 injured, significant damage to some buildings. And in Southern California, residents still sifting through the ashes of a weekend wildfire that destroyed 53 homes in Malibu. Police think a campfire may have ignited the blaze. You're listening to the Quality News Network.
I know your secret. Nobody told me, but I know. Every time your little girl wants you to read her a story and you tell her you're too busy, I know. When your boy needs help with homework and you tell him to ask his mother, I know. Your wife asks you whether the warranty is still good on the broken dishwasher and you tell her you're too tired to look for it, I know. You're very good at keeping the secret, but it does take a lot of effort to keep the charade going. It could be very scary and embarrassing if anyone found out. But I know your secret. You can't read. Neither can 93 million American adults. You're in big company. Instead of running scared, become a hero in your own family. Find a local literacy program at your library. It's free. The day you whisper in your wife's ear, "Honey, I can read," just watch how big her smile is.
This message on literacy has been brought to you as a public service by the Quality News Network. For more information, please contact your local library.
China will buy $15 billion worth of airplanes from European manufacturer Airbus. The 160-aircraft deal announced during a visit by French President Nicolas Sarkozy, his first trip to China as president. The first weekend of U.S. holiday sales beating both Wall Street and retailers' expectations, a 7% increase over this time last year. The big winners were electronics stores and discounters. Conversely, retail stocks fell today as investors took in largely bearish reports about the seasonal shopping kickoff. Fears that the U.S. economy could be headed toward a recession, coupled with a housing slump and soaring oil prices, took the edge off the unexpected increase in initial holiday sales. The euro crept higher today to $1.48 per single euro. And on Asian markets today, gold jumping to nearly $829 an ounce as investors anticipated another cut in U.S. interest rates. Platinum hit record highs as well. Light sweet crude oil trading at $97.70 a barrel on the New York Mercantile Exchange. At today's close of Wall Street, the Dow dropping 237 points to end at 12,743. NASDAQ down 55 points. The S&P 500 down 33. There's always more at our website, qualitynewsnetwork.com. I'm Barbara Lewis.
Gather around the radio, kids. It's time for Strictly Confidential. It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the Dominionists and the loyal Bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore. So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbold.
Good evening, America, and good morning, world. Welcome to Book, Chapter, and Verse 77 of Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold, and welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio, exclusively on the listener-supported Head On Radio Network. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day. Today is, in fact, Monday, November the 26th, so if you're listening a little after 9 p.m. on a Monday, that is November the 26th, you are indeed listening to a live show, and you're welcome to phone in and talk to myself and the guest whom I'll be introducing shortly. If you are listening to this show via the archives, welcome aboard also. You won't be able to call in, of course, because I won't be here, but nonetheless, you are welcome, and thank you for listening. I've recently, over the extended weekend, have gotten a clue as to the number of people who are listening to the archives, listening to the show at a later time than when it actually runs, and I must tell you, thanks, folks. There's a lot of people out there clicking at Strictly Confidential, and it is appreciated. The show site is strictlyconfidentialradio.com. There you're going to find links to all of the guests and to the audio archives from past shows. You'll find links to the guests' websites there also. You'll find links to the chat room, which is active as I speak, and you'll find links to the audio archives, as I said a moment ago, and the Head On Radio Network main site. And you can find about all the other progressive programming on the Head On Radio Network. There are also links there for Strictly Confidential's MySpace page and links to help you locate the music that you hear on the show. I trust everyone had a wonderful Thanksgiving holiday. It has been, 4 days since I've been on the air. We did not go live on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, or Sunday night. And I must tell you, I've almost forgotten how to do this. There's so many knobs and so many lights. And I think I have all the correct buttons pushed, however, and things should go well. Our guest this evening is a much-anticipated guest. It's Bishop John Shelby Spong. Bishop Spong was actually suggested to me as a potential guest by someone in the chat room quite a while back, and he was traveling worldwide at the time, and this was the soonest opportunity we had to get him on the show. The couple of times that he has come up in the chat room, I've typed in something about Spong will be on such and such a date, and invariably, several people immediately go, "You mean Bishop John Spong?" There's quite a lot of interest to have this fellow on the show. I, too, am intrigued by him. He's sold more than a million copies of books that he's written. He is the retired bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of New York. He was there for 24 years. His admirers acclaim him as being a teaching bishop who makes contemporary theology accessible to the ordinary layperson, and he's considered a champion of an inclusive faith by many people. This, of course, means he has many enemies. There's no shortage of articles on the web with titles like "Rescuing the Gospel from Bishop Spong" by the right wing, and I believe he'll tell us all about his experiences with right. I'm sure he's had more than one. He is a committed Christian who spent a lifetime studying the Bible, and his life has been deeply shaped by it. Bishop Spong says that he's not interested in Bible bashing. "I come to this as an interpretive task, not as an enemy of Christianity. I'm not even a disillusioned former Christian, as some of my scholar friends identify themselves. I'm a believer who knows and loves the Bible deeply, but I also recognize the parts of it have been used to undergird prejudice and mask violence." He is a lecturer at universities and churches worldwide. He delivers more than 200 public lectures each year to standing room only crowds. His book titles are "Rescuing the Bible from Fundamentalism" is one, "A New Christianity for the World," "For a New World" is two, "Why Christianity Must Change or Die," that's a very, very short list. He's just come back from a trip to Wales and to London and to Scotland and South Africa, and we'll have to find out about his future speaking dates. I believe he's coming up in Toledo fairly soon. So those of you who live in Toledo might be able to catch one of his lectures. He is certainly sought after. His media appearances have been everything from Good Morning America, The Today Show, This Morning on CBS, The Phil Donahue Show, Firing Line with Debate with Pat Buchanan, McNeil Lehrer, The O'Reilly Factor, God help him. I had some quotes from that show. It was pretty typically Bill O'Reilly. And he lives in New Jersey with his wife, Christine Mary Spong. They have five children and six grandchildren, and again, they live in New Jersey. Bishop Spong, welcome to Strictly Confidential.
Thank you, Peter. It's good to be with you.
It's good to have you here, sir. I've been anticipating this for quite a long time. I have to say also that today I called myself, at least, brushing up on Bishop Spong. But you're not the sort of person one could simply brush up on. It's sort of like trying to brush up on nuclear physics. You are such a person of such wide breadth, I hardly know where to begin. Perhaps I ought to begin by telling you a little bit about our audience. That might be helpful to you. We have a large number of heterosexual listeners who are progressive and sympathetic to the LGBT cause. They don't necessarily understand us all that well. That's one of the purposes of the show, to get out a true picture of what we're like as opposed to the Hollywood version. Of course, we have a large number of LGBT folks who join us at 9 p.m. also. So the audience is wide and diverse, and it consists of people like myself who are still in the church and who are disillusioned. It consists of people who have left the church and are disillusioned. It consists of people who are so disgusted by it that they react in extreme anger at the mere mention of Christianity, and of course, atheists too. It's the whole gamut. It's humanity as a whole. Maybe you could start by telling us about how you your experiences when you were a kid and your background in coming up in the church.
I might take the whole program, but because I've lived a long time. I grew up in the Bible Belt of the South in North Carolina. I was taught that segregation was the will of God, that men were quite superior to women, that it was okay to hate other religions, and especially the Jews, and that homosexuals were either mentally sick or morally depraved people who needed to be either cured or converted. And the Bible was quoted to justify each of those prejudices. So that the course of my life has been a course of trying to get out from under this early Christian upbringing. Usually when people have that kind of upbringing and they get away from it, they get away from the church, they get away from Christianity because it's been such a negative experience. The reasons that I'm not fully sure I can articulate, that was never something I wanted to do. What I wanted to do was to get to the core of the Christian faith and to redefine it in the light of what I think the gospel message is. My favorite text in the Bible is the quotation attributed to Jesus by the fourth gospel, who said, "I've come that you might have life and have it abundantly." And I think anything that diminishes the life of any human being cannot possibly be of God. And so that's sort of the marching order that I live with. And I've been privileged to be elected to the highest position my church has to offer. And I've tried to carry that theme and work for the enhancement of life for black people, for women, for gay and lesbian, bisexual and transgender people, and to foster a dialogue between Christians and the other great faith traditions of the world without playing, "I'm okay, you're not okay, and you're not going to be okay until you get to be just like me," which is, I think, the way most missionary and conversion activities are carried out. So that's in a thumbnail sketch. I'm a happily married man, and my wife and I have been to many, many gay and lesbian events across this country, and I consider it a privilege to stand at their side, and I consider it a privilege to accept the abuse that has been their daily bread so often from my fellow Christians for standing there.
Well, thank you. To stand with us is certainly not always the easiest thing to do, and people of your stature doing it, it's immensely helpful. Bishop Spong, I've recently read a book called Misquoting Jesus and another book called Steeplejacking, subtitle, How the Christian Right is Hijacking Mainstream Religion. Now, the book called Steeplejacking goes into a discussion about the IRD, the Institute on Religion and Democracy, which is apparently a Republican think tank. And
it's worse than that. It's a right-wing religious Texas-funded think tank that is deliberately seeking to disrupt any kind of progressive Christian mentality.
Well, it's a very disturbing organization, and I keep getting input about the extremely wealthy folks who are funding it. But what caught my eye in reading through some of your materials today is where you said that the divergence between what the ministers are learning in Bible schools or in universities about the Bible and the verses and the interpretations is not at all what is being taught to the people in the pews. And you have indicated that this separation between what's being taught and what's being said in congregations goes back 250 years, I believe you said, which of course far exceeds the IRD. So maybe you could tell us how all this started. It's a horrifying thing to think what's happening.
Well, there's been something called critical biblical scholarship. It started actually in Germany about 250 years ago, and it's taught in every theological seminary except some of the things like Oral Roberts University or Liberty Baptist or Bob Jones University, the ultra-fundamentalistic schools. They hardly know that this scholarship exists. But in all the mainline theological seminaries, people learn this. And then they go back to their parishes and they begin to say some of these things, and they disturb people's security systems. So there's a lot of anxiety and a lot of hostility and a lot of tension that goes on, and so they finally stopped doing it. For example, I don't know any competent biblical scholar in the world today that would argue that the birth stories of Jesus in Matthew and Luke are in fact history. You know, we don't live in a world where stars can travel through the sky so slowly that wise men can keep up with it. We don't live in a world where a fetus of John the Baptist in the womb of his mother Elizabeth can leap to salute the fetus of Jesus in the womb of his mother Mary to demonstrate that Jesus is going to be superior to John the Baptist when they grow up. Those are beautiful mythological stories that are designed to convey a point of view that the early Christians found it necessary to convey, but they're not history. No birth stories, when you think about it, are history, because you don't record the birth of a great person until the great person becomes a great person. Then you look back at the moment of his or her birth and you say, well, the day that person was born was a great day for human history. But nobody stands outside a maternity ward to wait for a great person to be born. It just doesn't work that way. And yet we've been taught for at least 1900 years that the only way to read the Bible is literally. And that's where I think you get into terrible troubles, because there's some literal texts in the Bible that are just plain awful. There's the story of God stopping the sun in the sky so the Jews can kill more of their enemies, the Amorites. There's the story of Samuel, who instructs King Saul to go out and commit genocide against the Amalekites. You know, there's a lot of things in the Bible that are nothing except hostile tribal religion that's in the faith story, I think you need to contend with those things.
You've summed some of these things up in some of your writings, anti-Semitism, sexism, and homophobia, along these same lines that have become at least to so many people an important part of their religion. And you've written that most Christians seem to assume that the details of their system, their faith system, just dropped out of the heavens, fully developed, but nothing could be further from the truth. I think you're saying that this is an evolutionary thing?
Well, the Bible was written between 1000 BCE and 135 CE. That's 2,000 to 3,000 years ago. I don't know anybody that would go to a medical textbook written 2,000 to 3,000 years ago to treat sickness today, or a geography textbook to determine the shape of the world, or a physics or chemistry textbook to talk about the various things that physicists and chemists would talk about. Because people between 1000 BCE and 135 AD made assumptions that we can't make. They assumed the earth was the center of the universe. They assumed that sickness was divine punishment. They assumed that God controlled the weather patterns.
Okay, I think we may have lost Bishop Spong there. I'm sure the studio will attempt to get him back on the line. It sounded like a disconnect on this end. As he was, yes, Bob is going to get him back. As he was saying that there are so many things that have happened from Copernicus and the thought that the Earth was the center of the universe, and so many things have changed. Yet, when I made the statement when I was quoting him earlier, most Christians seem to assume that the tails of their faith simply dropped out of the heavens, fully developed. This is the same mindset that refuses to accept evolution. They want to believe, or it's encouraging or helpful for them to believe, that they use their faith like a warm fuzzy as opposed to a way to find the truth, so that they can't accept evolution either, because everything has to be pre-made and a simple to follow formula, such that folks, I'm sorry, watching production chat, so that people can at least feel secure in their faith. And it's come up in my frame of reference anyway that in any religious system, as time goes by, as more and more information becomes available to people, there is always a backlash of extreme fundamentalism, which is what is occurring at this point in history. And so that being the case, we are certainly seeing that today, both in the Muslim community and in the Christian community, and in the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community. I don't hear anything about fundamental Buddhists, but they may very well be out there. It is hard to say. In any case, what we're going to do is, I think we have him back. Bishop Spong, do we have you back?
Yes, I don't know what happened to that phone. The one in my office wasn't working, so I was on one that doesn't have a cord. I think it burned out.
Yes.
But now I'm on a landline.
It's the joys of live radio. After you left, I was explaining to folks that this thing about the fundamentalism and hanging on to this basic system of faith. If you'll recall, just before you left, I had read where you had written, most Christians seem to assume that the details of their faith, the system just dropped out of the heavens, fully developed, which seems to be the same way they regard the creation story, that they're completely unable to accept any mechanism except ready, here you go, and the Lord just threw a switch.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's not the way it happened. Every ancient people had a creation story, because part of what ancient people had to do was try to figure out how they came into being, what they came from, and where they derived. So there's a mythology, but nobody's present to describe it. I remember reading a book by Dean Acheson, who was Mr. Truman's Secretary of State back in the 40s. In early 50s, and he wrote a book called Present at the Creation, which I thought was probably the most ostentatious title I'd ever seen. But what Dean Acheson was referring to was present at the creation of Americans' post-World War II foreign policy. But there are some people that think that the Bible was present at the creation of the world. Well, if you take the Bible literally, the world was created on 4004 B.C. or B.C.E. on an October afternoon about 4 o'clock Greenwich Mean Time. That's what Bishop Usher wound up figuring out. But we know from geological evidence and from carbon readings that this planet Earth has been here between 4.5 and 5 billion years. We know that life didn't come into this planet until at least 750 million years after the planet was formed. We know that human life, depending on how you define human life, is no more than 2 million years old at the most, and perhaps as young as 100,000 years at the least, again, depending on how you define human life. We know that there was no such thing as a finished creation that the book of Genesis talks about. There's no such thing as a fall, so original sin is a strange idea that got brought in from some alien point of view, and there's no such thing as God having to enter this world to redeem us from a fall that never happened so that God can restore us to a status we've never been. We weren't created perfect in God's image only to fall into sin and to need to be rescued. We were created as a single cell, and we have emerged into life. And the problem with human beings is not that we are fallen sinners. The problem is that we haven't yet become fully human. And so if the Christian faith begins to be dedicated to humanizing men and women around the world, calling them into a deeper and fuller humanity instead of rescuing them from sin, it's a whole different way to look at the Christ story, and I think that's the place we've got to move.
Well, I completely agree with you. In my reading that I did today, I came across a fascinating section where you ordered the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but not in that order, but in the order that they were actually written. And you were able to, by doing that, mask out the duplicate entries and watch over time how these stories evolved into huge legends. Could you tell us about that? I found it fascinating.
Yes. Mark is the first Gospel to be written, and it's probably dated between 70 and 72. Which the first thing that means is that it's at least 40 years since the earthly life of Jesus came to an end. So the first story we have about Jesus, first gospel story we have, is 40 years at a minimum after his earthly life has come to an end. And you have to raise some questions about what happened to the story of Jesus in those 40 years when it was passed on by word of mouth. The story clearly grew. But when you organize the Gospels in the order that they're written, Mark is first, and that's clearly established. Matthew and Luke both copy Mark. Mark has to be first. Matthew copies about 90% of him. Luke copies about 50% of him. And then John is the last Gospel written somewhere between 95 and 100. So the four Gospels are written between 70 and 100. And if you line them up and read them in that order, you will find you can watch the story grow. For example, in Mark's Gospel, a young man dressed in a white robe announces the resurrection. He's not an angel, he's just a young man in a white robe. When you get to Matthew's Gospel, he becomes a supernatural angel who travels on the wings of the wind and who has supernatural power. He can put the soldiers around the tomb of Jesus to sleep. He has the power to roll back the stone. He sits on top of it, and then he announces the resurrection. When you get to Luke, that angel has become two angels. And when you get to John, it's still two angels, but one of them sort of morphs into being Jesus of Nazareth, resurrected. See, you can watch that kind of development. In Luke, in the first gospel, Mark, there is no story of the appearance of the risen Christ to anyone. When you get to Matthew, there's the story about the women at the tomb seeing the risen Christ. But that story is not in Mark, and Matthew was copying Mark, and Matthew literally changed that. And there's no story in Luke about the women actually seeing Jesus. So if you take that one out, which is highly questionable, you've got the story of Jesus coming from heaven. That is, no story of the ascension's ever been written, but the only resurrection story that Matthew tells, where Jesus appears to the disciples, Jesus comes out of the sky, and the disciples climb up the earth. You also know that there's no birth story in Mark. Mark just doesn't have it. Mark says that God entered Jesus at the time of the baptism when the heavens opened and the Spirit was poured out upon him. That means you know that the first time the virgin birth story came into the Christian tradition, it was in the ninth decade in the writings of Matthew. It also appears in the writings of Luke, but it disappears by the time you get to John. There are just a lot of insights. The Sermon on the Mount is only in Matthew's Gospel. It's not in any other Gospel. No other Gospel thought that was something that they either knew about or could talk about. The raising of Lazarus is only in John. John's written between 95 and 100. You can't really believe that Jesus raised a four days dead person from the grave in a very big public ceremony with a lot of his critics as well as his friends gathered. And he actually rolls the stone away and the dead man comes out in his burial clothes and Jesus has them release him. And nobody writes about that story for 70 years, and then it suddenly appears in the fourth gospel. That stretches credibility. Now, all of this is so basic. You know, every biblical scholar knows this. But we don't share this with our people because somehow our people find their security in believing that everything in the Bible is the literal word of God. And, of course, it's out of that literal word of God that we read texts like Leviticus 18 and Leviticus 20, which are supposed to condemn homosexual people, or we read the Sodom and Gomorrah story, or we read the few verses in the Pauline corpus where he refers to sexual sin, which gets translated as sodomy and homosexuality, but it probably didn't mean that at all. So that the Bible, when it's literalized, becomes a weapon in the hands of frightened people to justify their prejudices and to enable them to minimize the humanity of the people who are the objects of their prejudice. And I've seen that happen thousands of times.
In reading through your material today, I was fascinated. I should have already known this, but I was fascinated to at least rediscover it, shall we say, that Paul's work actually predates all of the Gospels, and that, in fact, Paul mentions even less of these what we consider facts now. For instance, Chad is pointing out the virgin birth, that Paul never mentioned the virgin birth. Can you tell us how Paul fits?
Yeah, Paul says of the birth of Jesus, he was born of a woman, born under the law. That's the way everybody's born. Everybody's born of a woman. And only Jews are born under the law. And that's what he was talking about. He does say the best thing he says about Jesus' origins is that he was descended from the house of David. But there's nothing supernatural about that. Paul had just never heard of the virgin birth. He never mentions Mary or Joseph anywhere in his corpus. And Paul died in 64. At least that's the best estimate. The first gospel is not written until the early 70s, so Paul didn't know there was such a thing as a gospel. You can look at Paul. He gives you a few details about the life of Jesus, but they're very few. They're almost all in 1 Corinthians in chapters 11 and chapter 15. In chapter 11, he describes that on the night that Jesus was handed over, he instituted the Last Supper. And that's about all it tells you about it. It's not a Passover for Paul. When you get to chapter 15, he relates what he calls the final events in Jesus' life. And of the crucifixion, he says, he died for our sins in accordance with the Scripture. That's all he says. There's no Pilate, there's no high priest, there's no thief, there's no word from the cross, there's no... all of the things that we associate with the crucifixion, Paul didn't have any of that in it. And of the burial, he says, he was buried. No Joseph of Arimathea, no tomb, no sweet-smelling spices, no women coming to the tomb. All of those are stories that develop later. Paul also clearly never heard about Judas Iscariot. He never mentions that the handing over that he refers to in chapter 11 of 1 Corinthians was on the part of one of the disciples of Jesus. And when he gets to chapter 15, he says on the third day Jesus was raised and he appeared to the 12 disciples, which clearly includes Judas Iscariot. So that there are lots of the traditional stories that have developed in that period of time between 30 and 70, when the Gospels began to be written.
Well, also, in what I've discovered by reading so many of your works today, as many as I could possibly fit in, there's the whole thing about the ascension that apparently was not in the earlier Gospels, that was added later, that Jesus came back as a man in the flesh, but originally perhaps the intent was that he came back as a spirit. Please elaborate on that. This is of great interest to me.
The ascension story is added to the tradition by Luke, and he just alludes to it in chapter 24. And then when Luke writes the book of Acts, he gives it sort of a chronological detail in chapter 1 of the book of Acts. We're talking there about somewhere between 88 and 95. Mark didn't have any story of the ascension. Paul believes that resurrection and ascension were the same thing. He believes that, and this is, you have to read 1 Corinthians 15 in detail to get this, but he believes that what happened at the resurrection was that God raised Jesus from the dead into the presence of God as part of the living reality of who God is. And it is out of God that he appears to certain chosen witnesses. And then Paul lists those witnesses, and he says it was to Cephas first, that's Peter, and then to the 12, that's the disciples that are identified, including Judas Iscariot, and then to 500 brethren at once, and we have no data on what that was about, and then to James and to the apostles, and we wonder who the apostles are because they're clearly not the 12, and then Paul says he appeared to me, to Paul. Well, Paul's conversion is no earlier than 1 year and no later than 6 years after the crucifixion, and Paul says that the same experience that he had of the risen Christ was what everybody else had, except that his was last. If you read the Bible carefully, you escape all this mindless fundamentalism. Just remember, Peter, that for most people, religion is not a search for truth, it's a search for security. And in order to have security, you've got to believe that you have the truth. That's why Protestants claim they've got an inerrant Bible, and that Roman Catholics claim they've got an infallible Pope. And almost every religion claims that it is the only true religion and that we control salvation. No one can come to the Father except through our religious tradition. All of those are the manifestations of a very insecure humanity that is looking for a kind of authoritarian security system. And what I think we've got to learn about the Christian faith is that it never will give us this security. It will give us the ability to live as insecure people in a radically insecure world. And we need to embrace that as a virtue, not a vice. It's when people believe they possess the truth of God that they always put their wagons in a circle and begin to shoot at anybody that disagrees with them. And that is hardly the message that the Christian gospel should culminate in its communication to the world.
One of the folks in chat is mentioning regarding a scholarly ministers, people who have been educated at the great institutions, who are aware of these things but don't tell the people in the pews, and he's suggesting that this is at least in some way fraud. I'm wondering, too, if it's not that clear effort to just keep everybody together, this whole unity thing. It's like the thing that's going on with the LGBT community and the churches being divided by it. Still, there are people looking for some sort of middle of the road where everybody wants to be kept together as one congregation versus doing the right thing.
I think unity is a virtue, but I don't think it's the greatest virtue. I think truth is the greatest virtue. And there's some things that you just can't compromise. That is, either black people are human or they're not human. And if they're human, you cannot enslave them, you cannot segregate them, or you cannot treat them as victims of apartheid. And when you get to the gay or lesbian issue, either homosexuality is something evil or it's something normal but minority. Well, everybody in the medical and scientific world today now regards homosexuality as just one more variation in the human race. We have left-handed people and right-handed people. We have gay people and straight people. That's just normal. And you do not condemn anybody for what they are. Now, in the history of the Christian faith, we have condemned women because we thought they were inferior men. We have condemned people of color because we regarded them as subhuman. I've just come home from South Africa, and the laws under the apartheid regime in South Africa define people of color as subhuman. So they justified not educating them. Black people in South Africa under apartheid were educated only to the level where they could do manual labor because they were thought unfit to ever learn anything more. Now, can you imagine that kind of definition being applied to Desmond Tutu or to Nelson Mandela? I mean, those are black people that were able to work through that dreadful system and still develop their own skills and power to compete with anybody in the world. But if you keep people under suppression, you kill the creativity in so many of them, and it will take us a couple of generations to get over what we've done to black Africans. The same thing is true of women. I'm not here to endorse Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign, but the fact that Hillary Clinton is a serious candidate for the presidency is a consciousness-raising moment for our nation, because whether people like her or dislike her, nobody can fail to imagine that she can be elected president. That's the great contribution she's made, whether she's elected or not. And in some sense, Barack Obama is doing that for black people, and in some sense, Bill Richardson's doing that for Hispanic people, though Bill Richardson doesn't look terribly Hispanic, but he's got a Mexican mother. But these are all consciousness-raising things that challenge the negativity that we have put on various minorities. And of course, the fact that we've got Barney Frank, who's an openly gay representative in the House of Representatives, and until fairly recently we had an openly gay Republican in the House of Representatives from Arizona, so that these people are now out of the closet and people have to challenge their stereotypes in the light of the knowledge that they have of these people living in open gay lives in the public arena. That's a great thing. Let me say a positive word about George Bush so I can be nonpartisan. The great thing George Bush has done is to put black people into the foreign policy spokesman roles for the United States, in Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice. He has forced the world and the citizens of this country to hear a black face with a black voice as the voice of foreign policy for the United States of America, and the country will never be the same because of that. Now, we can debate their foreign policy. That's another issue. But that's a great accomplishment. And I think it's important that we recognize that's how our consciousness changes, that we have to adjust to a different reality from the one our prejudices have defined for us.
Very good point. There's so many questions coming from the chat room. I'm going to try to assimilate two of them together. One is, how do we convey this kind of common sense to people who think the Bible is literal fact? And also, an observation of my own, I think the veneer may be cracking. I personally was in a Bible study group at Little Methodist Church not too far from here. Oh, it's been about a year ago. And something came up about how, pardon my ignorance, some tribe, there were no black people until some tribe got cast out into the desert, and then the sun turned them black and some rigmarole. And so I looked and I said, so what you're telling me is you think that civilization is 6,000 years old, and that within 6,000 years these people turned black? And you could see the shock on the person's face that they didn't really want to say yes because it seemed incredulous, but at the same time they said yes. Do you see the veneer?
Because the human race actually started in Africa. We were all black at the beginning. Africa is our home. Most people think that humanity began either in what is now South Africa or what is now the grasslands of East Africa, because we've got archaeological and geological evidence in both places of early human life. And the blackness of the skins of our ancestors was nature's protection against the rays of the sun. Black skin is caused by high melanin content. And as these human beings, Homo sapiens, began to migrate, and they've migrated all over the world by now, none of them are native to the Western Hemisphere or to North or South America, but they migrated, and as they migrated further and further north, the need for melanin in their skin was less and less. So by the time you get up to Sweden, you've got these pale-faced, blonde, blue-eyed creatures. And then, according to the best anthropological charts that I can follow, they swept from Europe back over into Asia and then down into southern India. And as they did, the need to survive with more melanin in your skin was present. So if you can go to some cities in southern Asia and the skin of the Indian people there is as black as anybody in Africa, but their hair is straight and their features are Western features instead of Negroid features. And, you know, anybody that spends any time studying anthropology would know that that's very basic. We got people into this country primarily because in an ice age, the Bering Straits, you could get from Asia into the United States through the Bering Straits in Alaska, and then they came down into North and South America. That's why the native Indians, as we call them, the Native Americans, are all Asians. And, you know, we can test that with DNA today. They came over here from Asia. And it was not until much later that Leif Erikson and finally Christopher Columbus brought Europeans over to this country. So that, you know, it's a shame that religion gets identified with ignorance. Because nobody in their right mind today opposes evolution. DNA evidence makes that so very clear. And nobody today who knows anything about anthropology would suggest that blackness is some sort of divine punishment of a tribe that got cast out and put back into Africa. We all started from Africa, and we were all black people at the very beginning, and we've got to begin to recognize that.
Well said. There is a war on science conducted by the administration, you could say or maybe not say. That's maybe a personal opinion, but nonetheless, some of these people will...
Correct.
Some will tell you that
the war on science is that Mr. Bush is in league with the southern religious mentality that's basically fundamentalistic, so he has to punch that card from time to time, and he does it with little interesting vignettes. He suggests that school children ought to be taught evolution and creation because they need to make up their minds for themselves. Well, you know, if you want to teach your children creation science, it's up to you, but don't put it in a science class because it's not scientific and it does not represent anything that we know about truth. Evolution is a pretty well-established theory. And we know that today because even the viruses that we vaccinate ourselves against, the flu virus, for example, is always going through mutations and changes so that they will survive the next round of vaccination. So we're in a constant war in the evolutionary world where vaccinations have to change regularly to keep up with the mutations in the viruses. We also do organ transplants from animals to human beings. You couldn't do that if there wasn't a certain compatibility. And the DNA evidence, the human genomes that we just discovered a few years ago, now can show great concentration of identity, something like 99.9% of the DNA content on a human being is identical with the great apes. Something like 75% of the DNA of human beings is kin to the fruit flies. And we are part and parcel of the expanding life of this world. And I think we need to embrace that instead of trying to quote the Bible, prove that's not true. That's a rather ignorant thing to do. But you see, religion is afraid of that. And we've been afraid of that for a long time. You know, the church condemned Galileo in the 17th century because Galileo challenged the way we understood the Bible. Well, it was in 1991 that the Vatican finally put out a paper and announced that we now believe that Galileo was right. But we started doing space travel about 1950. And we couldn't do space travel if Galileo was wrong, because we would have bumped into the roof of the sky. But Galileo was right, even though they tried to put him to death in the 17th century. The same thing has happened with Isaac Newton, with Sigmund Freud, with Albert Einstein, with Charles Darwin. The Christian church constantly challenges the scientific insights, and the Christian church always loses. I don't know of a single issue in the public arena where the Bible has been quoted to maintain a prejudice where the Bible didn't lose. You know, in 1215, we quoted the Bible to challenge the Magna Carta and to support the divine right of kings, and the Magna Carta won and not the divine right of kings. We quoted the Bible to justify slavery. We quoted the Bible to condemn Galileo. We quoted the Bible to justify the second status of women. We quote the Bible today to justify our negativity toward gay and lesbian people. That's an ignorant use of the Bible, and it's time we began to say so loudly and publicly.
Couldn't agree with you more. I'm going to bring up, as I said, several people in chat are intensely and keenly listening to you, which tells me that the audience as a whole is paying rapt attention to you. One of the folks is mentioning that we have a host on this network. His name is Rick Goodner, and that during his first show, he mentioned something about the third commandment, taking God's name in vain, and he emphasized that the word vain as in vanity. And that speaking for God and trying to say that you speak with the authority of God is in fact taking the Lord's name in vain, and because you're speaking out of vanity. Does that make sense to you from what you know of the Bible?
Not a whole lot.
Make sense?
Not a whole lot. You know, when I was growing up, that commandment was thought to be condemnation of cursing. Now, that's the way I was raised, but it didn't have anything to do with that either. And you need to remember that in the ancient Jewish society, they didn't have lawyers and they didn't have courts. So when they'd contract a deal, I'll give you so many acres of land for so many head of cattle, they would clasp hands and they would swear in the name of the Lord that they would be true to their word. And then if one of them broke their word in that bargain, they had taken the name of the Lord in vain. That's what it's about originally. But that's history. If you hit your thumb with a hammer and say something like, gosh darn it, that's what people thought was, no, I don't, that's blasphemy. I don't think blasphemy is very nice. When a person says to another person, go to hell, they're acting as if they have the power to consign them to hell, and that's a divine power. So in that sense, they're claiming that they are God. And that's blasphemy, as I say, and it's not a very desirable characteristic. But it's got little to do with the third commandment. And the fourth commandment says that you're to observe the Sabbath day, but the Christian church stopped observing Saturday, which is the Jewish Sabbath, a long time ago. It doesn't say anything about observing the first day of the week. It's observing the seventh day of rest. But we didn't have any great problem shifting that. And there's a lot of parts of the Old Testament that we like to ignore. Most Christians don't keep the kosher dietary laws that are in the book of Leviticus. But they do like to quote the book of Leviticus to condemn gay and lesbian people. And I think that's where if you're going to do one, you got to do the other. You know, I made a study some time ago, Peter, of the number of crimes that you can commit for which you could be executed according to the Bible. And, you know, there wouldn't be many of us left. You could be executed for talking back to your parents. That'll take care of a goodly chunk of the human race. You could be executed for worshiping a false god. You could be executed for committing adultery. You could be executed for having sex with your mother-in-law. That's one I've never heard preached on, because I think most people have a hard time even imagining that. But, you know, those are the people that make claims for the Bible have either never read it or they've closed their minds to great chunks of its reality. There's some parts of the Bible that you do not want to blame on God. And there are also some parts of the Bible that lift the human spirit into the very presence of God. And that's the way we've got to learn how to read the Holy Scriptures.
I agree. And so many people who are sitting in the pews not only do not know science, they really don't know the Bible. They only know what the...
That's true. We live in a biblically illiterate age, and you can almost say anything comes from the Bible and nobody will know any better. And, you know, some of the stuff is really dreadful. In one book I wrote called Living in Sin with a question mark, I analyzed all of the biblical texts that have been used to condemn homosexuality. You couldn't make a case for the condemnation of homosexuality in any court of America on that basis. There are 9 texts, 4 of them are spurious, because they're simply a reference to Sodom or Gomorrah, or they use a word that might mean a male prostitute in the pagan world, but it gets translated as a homosexual. There are really only 4 of them that are very serious, and one's a Sodom and Gomorrah story, and that's a story about Middle Eastern hospitality laws. It's not a story about homosexuality, and it's a strange story, because when the before the story is over, Lot, who is claimed to be a righteous man, has offered his 2 virgin daughters to the men of the city to be gang raped instead of the 2 male visitors that he has given protection to, and he's still called righteous. And before the story is over, Lot has an incestuous relationship with both of his daughters and gets them pregnant. Now, I don't know whether you live in a different world from the world I live in, but any father who offers his daughters to be gang-raped and then who later has an incestuous relationship with them while he's drunk and gets both of his daughters pregnant is hardly one that I'd put under the category of the righteous. And then the Leviticus 18 and 20, one says that if you lie with a man as with a woman, you are it's an abomination. Chapter 20 says you should be put to death. Well, I'm happy to tell you that even Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson don't go as far as wanting to execute all the gay people in this country. Now, in their privacy, they may say some pretty dreadful things, but they would never make that sort of statement publicly. And, of course, homosexuality is such a confusing issue to so many, because sometimes the people that are persecuting gay people are themselves self-hating gay people. Remember Ted Haggard, the pastor of that huge evangelical church in Colorado City who got caught with his male prostitute lover. And he's one of the most vocal critics of homosexuality and condemning homosexuality. And so after he gets caught and dismissed from his church, he goes into a prayer therapy, and about 6 weeks later he announces that he has been cured and now he's 100% heterosexual. Well, that's nothing except fodder for the late night comedians on television, and they had a field day with that sort of stuff. I don't think you can get away with that kind of ignorance in today's world.
Well, at some point today, I came across that you actually knew Jerry Falwell personally.
Yeah,
is that, is that true?
Together. I've debated with him on television.
Well, the question that comes to mind is there was a quote, and if I'm not mistaken, it was Falwell, almost positive it was Falwell. It had to do with fundraising, and the topic of homosexuality came up. And I believe Falwell made a reference that if homosexuals didn't exist, we would have to create them relative to how big of a fundraiser that hot button was.
Jerry's dumb enough to say that publicly, but you never know. He said some rather dreadful things. When I lived in Lynchburg, he hadn't quite started Liberty Baptist College. It was really a segregation academy at that point. It grew into Liberty Baptist College, and Jerry grew. He got over some of his racism. But he was really deep in that old segregation pattern. He called Nelson Mandela a communist, and he said that South Africa's apartheid regime was saving the whole continent of Africa from a communist takeover, and some other things for which he should be pretty embarrassed today. But that's, you know, that's where Southern religion is. That's where I grew up. And, you know, I'd had a debate with Jerry Falwell on Good Morning America with Charles Gibson when he was the host of the ABC morning program. And Jerry was a lot of things. I don't think he was evil. I don't think he was terribly enlightened. But and he didn't know much about the Bible. Anybody that believes that every word of the Bible is the inerrant word of God has clearly never read it. I mean, I could show him passages that he would surely say, that can't be the word of God. Like the psalmist who says, you're not going to be happy until you take the children of your enemies and dash their heads against the stones. Well, surely that's not the word of God.
Which is one of the reasons I have such a hard time with it. I oscillate between it, they're just evil. I oscillate between they're just ignorant, and then I go to they're just using it to raise funds. No matter how you look at it,
yeah, there's some fundraising, but I think to give my conservative fundamentalist friends their due, I think they basically do believe what they're saying, and therefore they see anybody that opposes them as somehow evil because they've gotten their ideas and God all identified with each other. And I think that's unenlightened fear more than it is anything else. I grew up in that kind of world. I know the security that comes from believing that God, you understand God perfectly. You know, there's something about that that's rather appealing. It's just not real. God is a mystery beyond anybody's comprehension. I don't know why anybody thinks they understand who God is. I mean, how could a horse, for example, explain what it means to be human? A horse can't get outside the boundaries of being a horse. Well, how can a human being explain what it means to be God? No human being can get outside the boundaries of our humanity. That's why most of the time we create God in our image. It's not the other way around. God is, for most people, a great big supernatural human being. And I don't know what you do with that. Now, that's the way we have to think, but God is certainly mystery and wonder and transcendence and power far beyond any image that we would have. And I think we need to move quickly in that direction. I don't believe anybody can tell you who God is or what God is. I believe that all anybody can do is to tell you how you believe you have experienced the Holy God. And even then, you've got to say, you know, I might be delusional. A lot of religious people are delusional. But I don't think God is a delusion. I think God is a reality, but God is a mystery that we can experience, but we can never define. And when you begin to condemn people in the name of God, that's a clear, clear indication that you do not understand anything about the God who is defined as love in the Bible itself. God is defined as life in the Bible itself. God is defined as the rock underneath our feet in the Bible itself. But none of these are personal images. But they're the way human beings say they've experienced God, as the breath of life, as the wind that animates the forest, as the power that lifts us into new kinds of communities, as love. If you don't abide in love, you cannot possibly abide in God. That's the fourth chapter of the first epistle of St. John. Those are the biblical messages that people forget when they're trying to prove that they're right and anybody that disagrees with them is wrong.
Well, clearly, I completely agree with you regarding God being an eternal mystery, and as time passes, of course, we find out more and more answers, which is a direct contradiction to the people who believe that it's in the Bible and that's all there is to it. An eternal mystery can't be solved in that way, and in saying that, some of your detractors say that your only point is to prove that God's word is not in the Bible, or that God didn't write the Bible. That's this whole literalist thing. So that begs the question from the chat room, is that what would Christianity look like without all of that? What would it look without the literalism, especially say in the fundamentalist Southern? What do you think Christianity would look like?
Well, it took me a whole book I wrote on why Christianity changed or die and what a new Christianity would look like in a new world.
I didn't realize.
So I don't know that you can discuss that very quickly on an interview program, but I would say that we have to start with seeing that there's something good about life itself. I think all of life is holy. The reason I say grace before I eat a meal is that everything I'm going to eat was living, whether it's plant or animal, and it somehow had to die for me to keep on living. So I think you acknowledge that you're part of this life process. Everybody's in somebody's food chain, and right now we're at the top of the food chain, but when we die, we go right back into the food chain. You know, remember that old song about the worms crawl in and the worms crawl out and the worms crawl all over your snout? It's not very pleasant to think about that, but, you know, we grew up singing that song. But that's the nature of life. You're in this thing, and life is holy, and we need to appreciate that holiness and to live in it. And I think the problem with humanity is that we haven't become human. I think it's out of our fear that we hate people that don't look like us or act like us or worship like us. Xenophobia is part of the human survival mentality. And, you know, the church has contributed to that over the centuries. We spent a lot of our time in our history doing rather dreadful things. Look at all the religious wars. Look at anti-Semitism. The Christianity spawned anti-Semitism. Look at the Inquisition, when we burned at the stake anybody that had any questions about or disagreed with our creedal understandings. Look at what Hitler did to the Jews in the Holocaust. Look at what Europeans did to the Native American people in Australia. Look what Europeans did to the Maori people in New Zealand. Look at what Dutch people and English people did to the black populations of South Africa. You know, our history, and those were Christian people. You know, our history is so dreadful. We've taken our fears and we've made them into part of our religious syndrome, and we've justified our hatred of people who look different. That's what xenophobia is all about. Now, that's what prejudice is all about. Look at what we've done to women. Where did we get the idea that women were inferior human beings? Now, you can argue from the second story of creation, which you'll find in the fourth verse of chapter 2 of the book of Genesis on through chapters 3, that God created the man first, and then trying to find a good, proper friend for the man, created all the animals, and when none of the animals satisfied, God took a rib from Adam's side and created Eve to be his bride, and Eve was a second-rate human being. She wasn't in the image of God. She came out of the man. The man was in the image of God. But if you read the first creation story, which is actually the later one in Genesis 1, you'll discover that God creates male and female instantaneously together as two parts of the same humanity. And the church always followed that story from Genesis 2:4 on. It didn't follow the one in Genesis 1. It's Paul that quotes the one from Genesis 2:4 about the woman was not created. The man was not created for the woman, but the woman was created for the man. Well, that's just very strange. And Jesus was a radical. When you read the gospel story, Jesus violates all the rules about women. Jesus had female disciples. One of them was named Mary Magdalene, and he seems to have had a particularly close relationship with her. Jesus talks to a woman rather well in the Gospel of John, something that the religion of that day did not allow. Jesus allows Mary, the sister of Martha, to become a pupil, to sit at his feet as a learner. Women were not allowed to learn in that period of history. And Jesus is a radical feminist for his day. And that's because the message of Jesus is that every child of God is holy, every child of God is loved, every child of God is called to be all that that person is capable of being. So sexism or racial prejudice or homophobia are all things that diminish the humanity of another child of God, and they cannot possibly be squared with the gospel of Jesus Christ. And to me, the tragedy of our day is that the primary opponents of full justice and full inclusion for gay and lesbian people today are members of the Christian church. It is not an issue in secular society. The homophobia is rampant in the Midwest and in the South, in the fundamentalistic mentality, and it's time we got over it. It's also rampant, I might say, in the Christian church. You know, you don't take an institution like the Christian church that for the first 1,600 years of its life, and still in the majority movements of the Roman Catholic and Orthodox tradition, they don't allow priests to be married. at least in the Orthodox tradition, let me be correct. The Orthodox, if you're going to be a bishop, you can't be married, but a priest can be married. But no priest in the Roman Catholic Church can be married. And from about 300 to about 1600, and the Reformation came, all the clergy of the church were unmarried. You don't take an institution that requires you to be unmarried to have a leadership position and not expect to have attracted into that institution host hordes of people through the ages who had no desire to be married. So the priesthood has been significantly a gay priesthood throughout its history. And it's time we opened our eyes and saw that and admitted that.
Well, one thing that comes to mind, we've talked about so many things, but two of the things we've talked about is we've talked about the virgin birth, and we've talked about the ascension, and we've talked about the ways in which those are not actual fact. Nonetheless, though, if we take those things from people, we need to give them something else. So then who was Jesus? And who was Jesus then in this right way of thinking?
Well, once again, that's a great question. In my last book, which is entitled Jesus for the Non-Religious, I took about the last 75 pages to try to answer that question. Now, I don't know that I can shortchange it in a few minutes on a radio interview, but I will say that the absolute conviction of the early Christians was that somehow, in some way, through the full and complete humanity of Jesus of Nazareth, they believed that they had confronted the transcendent holy other that they called God. And I think that's the real issue, is the Jesus experience. Now, if you look at the New Testament and put it in the order in which it's written, Paul simply expounds that God was in Christ. He doesn't try to explain it. When he finally, in the Epistle to the Romans, tries to explain how God got into Christ, because they had an idea of God as a supernatural being who lived above the sky, and they had this experience with Jesus in which they believed they found God present in him, the question was, how did God get into him? And Paul says in Romans 1:1-4, that God declared Jesus to be the Son of God through the act of the Spirit of holiness at the time of the resurrection. Mark comes along in about 70-71 and says, no, God entered him at the baptism when the heavens opened and the Spirit of God was poured down upon him. Matthew, writing in the mid-80s, says, no, God became part of who Jesus is in the act of conception, and that's when you get the virgin birth story. Luke comes along from somewhere between 88 and 93, and he follows Matthew's line about the virgin birth. It changes a lot of the details, but by the time you get to John, John says that Jesus was the Word of God spoken in creation that simply got enfleshed in the life of Jesus of Nazareth, and he was born in a perfectly normal way, and John on two occasions says that Mary and Joseph are his parents. So all that's in the New Testament itself. So that if you take the five major writers in the New Testament, only two of them, Matthew and Luke, tell about the virgin birth. Mark and Paul seem never to have heard about it, and John, who probably heard about it, rejects it and doesn't continue it in his tradition, and he writes after all of them. So that, you know, the debate goes on even in the scriptures, so that when people think they can pick and choose which of their doctrines they're going to affirm with particular quotations from Holy Scripture, and don't bother to read the whole thing, they find that the debate on this is not something that I'm bringing up in the 21st century. This is something that's present in the biblical text from the very beginning of time, of the Christian era time, anyway. It's a great book, Peter. It's just that I'd rather spend their time understanding it.
Well, by the way, the book, this is Jesus for the Non-Religious, is that the title?
Yeah, that's the last one, came out in February.
Yes, and that book, and also Christianity Must Change or Die, If Christianity Cannot Change, It Will Die. Both those books are listed on the headonradionetwork.com site. If you go and click on this show, you'll see the books there, and you can click on them and order those books. I should give out the phone number again also. I don't know if I gave it out earlier. The toll-free line is 877, the number 4-HEAD-ON. That's 877-4-HEAD-ON. That translates into 877-443-2366. Or if you have unlimited long distance, please use that. You'll say the studio A. Nick Laura Buck, and that's area code 304-658-3333. That rings in West Virginia. email arrives to Peter at headonradionetwork.com if you would like to communicate with us that way. Let's talk about different paths to God. In reading your work earlier today, there was discussion. You were saying that you were born in the United States, so obviously you have a Christian heritage and you grew up in the Christian church. If you had been born in another country, you may have been a Muslim, or another country, you may have been Hindu. Obviously, I think that you are the sort of person who is drawn to this sort of mystery. Do you think that all of those paths lead us to God? Because what I'm getting at is the passage that, you know, where Jesus says nobody gets to God except through me, which maybe you can help me. I can't explain. Maybe you can help me.
Gospel, and it's one of what we call the I Am sayings, where Jesus is attributed. These words are attributed to Jesus. I am the bread of life. I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the vine. I am the good shepherd. I am the door. And it's in the I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. Jesus, in all probability, never said any of those things. Because the idea of Jesus walking around in Galilee or Jerusalem saying, oh, by the way, I am the bread of life, I am the living water, I am the resurrection and the life, that wouldn't have made a lot of sense. I think the Christian church found in him something that satisfied the deepest hunger, and so they have him say, I am the bread of life, or the deepest thirst, or the deepest sense of belonging, or the pathway to God. I have no trouble saying that Jesus is the only pathway to God for me. It's the pathway I walk. It's the pathway I have always walked. It's the way that I have been introduced into the meaning of God. But for me to say that, therefore, my pathway is the only pathway anybody else can ever walk, is for me to act as if I can tell God what means through which God can draw all people to God's self. And I don't think I've got that wisdom or that kind of gall. If I'd been born in Tibet, I suspect I would be a Buddhist, because that would be the only religious system that I've ever been introduced to. You know, born in Tibet, I would be a Muslim, because and my path is clearly the Christ path. But I don't believe God's a Christian. I believe that if you walk the pathway of Christ deeply enough, you transcend the limits of all human religious systems. And when you do that, whether you're a Buddhist or a Hindu or a Jew or a Muslim or a Christian, I think if you walk your pathway into the very depths of that faith tradition, you escape the limits of that system and you come into the mystery and wonder of God. And so I envision the day when I will sit down in a circle with Jews and Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists, all of whom have walked their path with integrity, and I will say to them, I walk the Christ path, and this is the pearl of great price that I have discovered in the Christ path, and I want to offer it to you. And they will say, well, I walk the Muslim path or the Buddhist path or the Jewish path, and this is the pearl of great price from my tradition that I want to share with you. And then each of us can take on the richness of every other tradition, and none of us has to give up the richness of our own tradition. And I think that's where we will have to go. The idea that my God is better than your God, so I think I'll go to war against you, is clearly not an idea that is compatible with the gospel of Jesus Christ.
Well said. One last question, and then we're going to take a caller. We have a caller who's waiting on hold. And I'm curious about the retroactive fulfillment of prophecy. Jesus said, you know, I came to fulfill all the prophets, you know, there's these various quotes from all the prophets in the Old Testament that about Jesus and when he would come and all that. What I'm understanding from you is that these fulfill the prophecy things were actually added later just so it would look like the prophecies were fulfilled.
That's again the theme of my book, Jesus for the Non-Religious. Yes, remember the Jesus story wasn't written until 40 to 70 years after his life had come to an end. In that 40 to 70 years, it was interpreted in word of mouth, and I argue in that book that the only place it could possibly have been interpreted was in the synagogue. Again, something people don't understand is the Christian movement lived within the synagogue until about 88 of the
of this common era, when the Orthodox Party took control and excommunicated the revisionist, as the early Christians were called. And the reason you know that the Christian story was remembered in the synagogue is by the time we get the Christian story written, the Jewish scriptures have been intertwined with the life of Jesus, and that could only have happened in the synagogue. People have not heard the scripture. The Bible was so terribly expensive that individuals couldn't own it. And there was no Gideon Society to put one in your hotel room. So that if you see the story of Jesus intertwined with the Jewish scriptures, as indeed it is, then that has to be something that took place in the synagogue, because that's the only place the Bible was read, studied, or interpreted. So what happened is that the story of Jesus was remembered in the synagogue, and in the process, the scriptures of the Jewish expectations and the prophets were wrapped around Jesus of Nazareth. The best place to see that is in the crucifixion story. The earliest story of the passion or crucifixion of Jesus is in Mark. It begins at the 17th verse of the 14th chapter, and it goes through the end of chapter 15. And almost every detail in the crucifixion story is taken out of either Psalm 22 or Isaiah 53. Why? Because there were no eyewitnesses. Now, all the disciples had forsaken Jesus and fled. Jesus died alone. So when they wrote up the story of how he was crucified, they had no eyewitness accounts to go on. So they went back to the servant passages of Isaiah, and they created the story of the crucifixion. Now, I don't mean to suggest that Jesus wasn't crucified by the Romans. I'm quite convinced he was. But all of the details of the thieves on each side of him, which they also grow in Mark's gospel, there are two thieves crucified on each side of him, and they don't say a word. In Matthew's gospel, the two thieves rail against Jesus in a quite negative. It's only when you get to Luke's gospel that one of them becomes the penitent thief. Again, that's a story that grows. The story of Joseph of Arimathea coming to do the burial ritual for Jesus is also a story that grows. Paul didn't know anything about that. It's introduced in Mark, and the story of Joseph grows through Matthew, Luke, and John. But if you go back and read Isaiah 53, you will discover that he is crucified with sinful people, or the servant dies with sinful people, and so that's where the thieves come from, and that he makes his grave with the rich, and that's where the Joseph of Arimathea story comes from. The other one, if you go back and read Psalm 22, you'll find that the words that Jesus, the only word that Jesus spoke from the cross according to Mark and Matthew was, my God, why have you forsaken me? And that's verse 1 of Psalm 22. And you can just go back and read that. And then you will find in Psalm 22 the story about they part my garments among them and they cast lots for my vesture. And that comes into the story as the soldiers rolling dice for the clothes of Jesus. The idea that he has thirst and says things like, I thirst, and they give him wine mixed with gall to drink. You'll find that in Psalm 22. You'll find the very conversation that goes on between the crowd and Jesus. If he's the Christ, or if he's what he says he is, let him come down from the cross and we'll believe him. You'll find echoes of that in Psalm 22. So that, the story is deeply intertwined with the Jewish scriptures. And I think that you have to begin to recognize that it wasn't that the scriptures predicted these things. It was that when they wrote the story of Jesus, they wrote it so it conformed with the expectations that the Jewish people had of who Messiah was, because Jesus was now interpreted as Messiah. He's not born in Bethlehem, for example, until you get to Matthew. He's certainly not born in Bethlehem in either Paul or Mark. And why was Bethlehem important? Because he was interpreted by that time to be the heir apparent to the throne of David, so he had to be born in David's city of Bethlehem. And that's why they have this almost convoluted story. Matthew believes that Mary and Joseph actually live in Bethlehem in a house. Luke believes that they live in Nazareth, and he has to get a tradition up to get them down into Bethlehem so that the Messiah can be born in David's city, so that we can sing a little town of Bethlehem instead of a little town of Nazareth. But all of that is part of the interpretive process. I don't know whether Jesus had 12 disciples or not. The fact is that you can't name them because the New Testament doesn't agree on what their names are. That's just a fact. But the number 12 is terribly important. Why?
because the old Israel had 12 tribes. The new Israel, and Jesus was interpreted as the founder of the new Israel, had to have 12 tribes, so he has 12 disciples. And those are the ways that scholars today are able to read the New Testament, and it's a fascinating, fascinating study. It does not diminish Jesus. It indeed enhances the story of this Christ figure to me.
Well, what I'm hearing you saying is that these new questions and things that we think we know that we really don't know are actually a gift. It's more of the mystery. It's more for us to contemplate. It's more for us to pray about. It's more for us to solve. It's the never-ending story, if that's what I'm hearing you say.
You and I today are writing the next chapter in the unfolding Jesus story, and I think that's a pretty powerful thing to recognize that we're doing.
I agree with you. And we have caller Jim on the line. Jim, welcome to the show. You have a question for the bishop.
No, sir. Just I would like to say I thank you both for being on the air tonight. And, Peter, I thank you for having the bishop. And sir, the bishop to the guest himself, your arguments are very compelling and very soul-searching. They give me pause for great thought, great concern.
Thank you, John. I'm having a hard time hearing, Jim. I think I heard what you had to say, but I just want to say thank you.
Well, I appreciate what you're saying. And I thank you both for sharing what you had to share tonight. And
thank you, Jim.
And there's one thing that I would like to add. It would appear to me as though the church throughout the ages has in certain ways developed what I call a call for personality, which can go many, many ways. And I think this has caused all of us the need to study further and to look further in, not only to our own beliefs, but only into our own hearts. Because I definitely believe that the kingdom of God is in your heart. No building. I mean, the buildings are beautiful, and I love them. And I love many of the traditions of the church. But what I wanted to say to you is I believe that the kingdom of God is in your heart.
Well, thank you, Jim. That's well said, and we appreciate your call. Thank you for calling this evening.
It's also biblical because in Luke's gospel, Jesus says on one occasion, folks, you stop looking for the kingdom to come. The kingdom is already within you. And I think that's only one verse, but I think it's a pretty potent verse.
We were talking earlier about the influence of the synagogue regarding the scriptures. I have heard other voices saying that there's a huge influence from the various cults that were around at the time, worshiping golden calves and all the different... Do you find that also in looking through the scriptures, some influence that they're trying to merge cults that were of the day?
I find that more in early Christian history than I do in the scriptures. Certainly there were competing mystery cults in the Mediterranean world. Mithraism, for example, was a major one, and there are a lot of connections between the way Christians understood the Eucharist and the way the Mithra religion, Mithraism, understood its sacramental meal. But I think when you get to the scriptures are basically Jewish books. The Gospels are Jewish books. People need to recognize that Mark and Matthew and John are all Jews by birth. Luke appears to have been a Jew by conversion. But that means all four of the Gospels are written by Jewish people, three by birth and one by conversion. And they are written for communities. Mark wrote for a Christian community, most scholars think maybe in Rome. Matthew wrote for a far more Jewish community. Luke wrote for a kind of Jewish community that had people of the dispersion and some Gentiles already beginning to come into the Christian faith. And John is the only one that's written after the split between the synagogue and the church, and that's why John appears to be deeply anti-Semitic. But he's talking about not Jews, he's talking about the Orthodox party of the Jews that just excommunicated the revisionist party of the Jews. But it's two groups of Jews that are hurling brickbats at each other, and And I think that's why John is interpreted today as anti-Semitic, and I think that's because they think it's Christians talking about Jews, and what it was Jews talking about Jews in the first century. John's Gospel, for example, has Jesus say that the father of the Jews is the devil. Well, that's pretty hostile. I can't imagine Jesus saying that, but I can imagine that the Christians who had been excommunicated from the synagogue could say of the Orthodox party that had excommunicated them that they were children of the devil. You know, because I think when you get into a great fight, you say terrible things about your opponents. We do that in every war. Remember in World War II, we didn't kill German boys and fathers. We killed Krauts, and we didn't kill Japanese sons and fathers. Maybe even daughters and mothers. We kill NIPS, and we kill VC, and we kill terrorists. We don't ever kill human beings. Because when you're in a battle for your own survival, you tend to demonize whoever your opponent is, and that's exactly what you have in the fourth gospel. But the gospels themselves are deeply Jewish books, and I think until we recover the Jewishness of it, that we're not going to ever understand them. The crucifixion is told in terms of the Passover. Is that because the crucifixion happened during the season of the Passover? No, I don't think so. It's because the Jewish Passover was used as the means of interpreting the death of Jesus. And Paul says that. He says, Christ is our new Passover lamb. The Passover lamb broke the power of death. Christ is the new Passover lamb who breaks the power of death. That's what Paul was talking about. And I think that's why they put the Passover into the crucifixion story into the Passover. And when Christians say things like, Jesus died for my sins, or if you're a Roman Catholic, you say that the sacrifice of the Mass is what you reenact every Sunday, the time when Jesus paid the price for your sins. They don't recognize that those come out of the Jewish day of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, where a sacrificial lamb was slaughtered and where the blood of the lamb was placed all over the mercy seat of God in the Holy of Holies, so that people could say the only way you can now come into God's presence is through the blood of the Lamb. And then the high priest would take some of the blood of the Lamb and sprinkle it upon the worshippers so the worshipper could say they'd been washed in the blood of the Lamb. That's Jewish language that we brought into the Christian story, and then we left the Jewish world, and people have interpreted these images without any knowledge of where they come from. And so you get the idea that God is an awful deity, apparent deity in the sky, who is angry at all us human beings for being so sinful, and God moves to punish us, but we can't abide the divine punishment. And so Jesus has to come, and God punishes Jesus instead of us, so we can say Jesus died for my sins. Well, that's a rather strange idea of God. It makes God an ogre, it makes Jesus a masochistic victim, and it makes you and me guilt-laden people. I don't think that's ever going to make us whole or make us human. And yet those images have been flowing through Christianity forever.
Yes, I completely agree. And there was a statement that you made in my earlier reading of your works today that it puts God in the position of being a scorekeeper. Me being in the computer business, I immediately thought that God was running an Oracle database. You know, how complicated it must be to keep the scores, especially when you factor in the sins are passed down from the mother and father through four generations. That's got to be one heck of a database to figure out.
Well, remember, the ancient image of God was that God lived above the sky and looked down upon us all the time and wrote down everything we did in the divine record books. So that when we came to the end of our path, God would simply open the record book and assign to us either the punishment or the blessing that we had earned. Well, that's a really strange view of God. That view of God is sort of hard to believe when you understand that above the sky is nothing but empty space. We've traveled up there today. They hadn't done that in the first century. But again, that's one of the places where the images of the past got locked in and literalized. And then when our new discoveries of how vast the universe is came, we had no way of being able to accept or understand those new images, because we were locked into our very primitive views of God as a parent figure who sits above the clouds. Now, that's not going to be the way that Christianity will live in the future. There might be a few neurotic Christians who will cling to those pre-modern images, but the vast majority of our world is not going to go back and revivify those kind of primitive images. We're moving on in another world. And if God cannot be understood in terms of the 21st century's world of relativism and the vastness of space and the idea that we didn't get created perfect and fell into sin, but we evolved into our humanity and we need to evolve some more into a new and deeper humanity, then I don't know who's going to acknowledge the power of the God that I believe we meet in Jesus Christ in the 21st century, because it's going to be harder and harder to do. And that's where I spend most of my time. I don't really write for the fundamentalist. I have no great desire to confront or to ridicule a fundamentalist. My mother died a fundamentalist. I just am writing for the people who are so turned off by that kind of primitive religion that they don't see any alternative except being a secular humanist or atheist. And I think that there's a great deal that can be said for the Christian faith that's powerful and profound, and that is not literally understood at all. But that's, you know, that's my audience. That's who I write for.
Well, I think that that's well said. And one of the things we bring up on this program from time to time is what we call the paperback book mentality of what's going on in the Christian church these days. Your writing would cause deep thought and a reevaluation of one's soul as it relates to their faith, things that they do. So what happens is you go to the Christian bookstore and you can buy thousands of little paperback books, which are all clearly very succinct and this, and it would be as if you'd have to be writing to the paperback book crowd to do that.
Well, that's right. My books are not generally sold in Christian bookstores. They don't want to sell them because they have condemned them generally. If I'm going to be sold, I'm going to be sold through Amazon and Barnes and Noble and the secular book markets. But there's a vast audience, Peter, of people who've been turned off by this primitive religion. You know, if I hadn't been able to escape that primitive kind of Christianity in which I was raised, I could certainly not be a Christian today. I'm not going to go through my life hating black people or gay people or treating women as if they're inferior, because that's the way my early Christian training taught me to believe. And I've got to get past that. And there are a lot of people who never get past that, and so they either go back and sort of shout loudly those ancient prejudices, or they give up on the whole religious enterprise. And what I want to do is to offer people another alternative. There's something between that kind of fundamentalism and no religion at all that I think is profound. And I think it has to do with life. And I think it has to do with Jesus, who calls people into a deeper and fuller life. It has to do with translating religion into an asset for living instead of a behavior-controlling guide. I don't want to be into reward and punishment, because I think that if you are a good person because you're going to get a reward, or because you want to escape some sort of divine punishment, that you're still doing everything you do for a very self-centered reason. I think we've got to get to the place where we do that which is right to do simply because it's right to do, without any fear of reward or punishment, but because that's the way one lives one's life. And when we get there, it'll be a new kind of humanity. And I think that if we don't get that to that place, we'll probably kill each other in the name of God in some sort of religious holocaust. That's where the world seems to me to be moving.
There are several other questions in chat, but before we get to those, I want to point out to you that we have a host. His name is John Fox, and John Fox is a host in Australia, and he actually does a show that begins at 12 o'clock midnight on this on the Head On Radio Network. And so that being the case, there's been a lot of political activity and Humpty Dumpty fell off the wall sort of things going on in Australia. And apparently you were recently in Australia for a Common Dreams conference, and apparently there was a lot of controversy about that. Could you tell us and share with us what happened with Common Dreams and what your experiences were in Australia and the general climate?
I love Australia. I've been there 9 times, and I think it's one of the most exciting countries in the world. The Common Dreams conference was something that a group of people who call themselves the Progressive Christian Network of Australia sponsored, and I went over and was their keynote speaker. It attracted 1,500 people from all over Australia.
It was held in Sydney at a Uniting Church, Pitt Street Uniting Church in downtown Sydney. The Anglican Church in Sydney is super fundamentalistic. It's sort of like 19th century Northern Irish people settled in the South Pacific and never changed. It's ultra-evangelical. And so the Archbishop of the Anglican Diocese of Sydney, he was first of all upset that 1,500 people were coming into his city that weren't fundamentalists but were still Christians. Not a process.
Yes.
And I've known him for a long time, and so he made this big public announcement that I was banned from any Anglican church in Sydney. Well, I hadn't planned to speak at any Anglican church in Sydney either. That's not my audience. That'd be like my speaking at Jerry Falwell's church. It's not my desire. But he thought that this was a nice thing to do. Well, all he did was to triple the kind of media coverage that I got. So I must have done 50 media interviews across Australia in every newspaper, and even got a story in a man's magazine. I don't usually get God and religion into a male magazine. I don't know yet what they use for the centerfold. But, that's an unusual experience for me. And there was not a newspaper in Australia that didn't cover my trip. So I found it rather exhilarating. And Jesus for the Non-Religious rocketed into the bestseller list of nonfiction books in all of Australia while I was there. And all of this is being attacked by the fundamentalists right and left, but that only increased the crowds. I didn't speak to a single audience there at a single bookstore, and I must have done 20 bookstore events where it wasn't a standing room only crowd. It was a very exciting visit, and I hope to go back. I really have great, great affection for that country.
And so this great fundamentalist influence in the church there, like in the United States,
probably the most fundamentalistic Anglican or Episcopal part of the whole communion of which I'm a member. And they don't even get much acceptance in the rest of Australia. It's just the Sydney place which is peculiar and unusual. And they're deeply homophobic. My God, they spend more time trying to condemn homosexuals than they do preaching the gospel of the love of God. But the Sydney Archbishop also thinks all Roman Catholics are antichrist. The Pope is the antichrist and all Roman Catholics are pagan. That's pretty arrogant. That's the largest Christian body in the world, and like every other body, the Roman Catholic Church has some great leaders and it's got some mediocre leaders and some bad leaders. But blanket condemnation. He wouldn't even appear on the same podium when the Pope paid a visit there some years ago, which I think that's dreadful. I would welcome the Pope. I disagree with the Pope on a lot of issues, but I would welcome him as a fellow Christian, and it would never occur to me to excommunicate the Pope. Might occur to the Pope to excommunicate me, but it wouldn't occur to me to excommunicate the Pope.
No doubt you're on the short list.
But I think it's Paul VI that he refused to even appear on the same podium, and that's when he called him the Antichrist. That kind of religious mentality is simply not something I want to pay much attention to. So I was actually grateful because his public attacks did nothing except awaken the very audience I seek to reach. And so I had a better opportunity to reach people in Australia than I've ever had. So I'm really grateful.
Well, I think that's wonderful. I don't know all the details. John will be sharing that later this evening in his show, but apparently there's a great political upheaval there that the ultra-conservative leadership apparently has lost control
of. Just been voted out of office. Yeah, they've got a new prime minister named Kevin Rudd, and the old prime minister, John Howard, was probably the only person left in the world that was supportive of George Bush's war in Iraq. And it was an interesting election to watch the Kevin Rudd is a very bright, attractive young politician, and he represents a different generation. John Howard didn't even retain his seat in the legislature, I understand, which means that he won't even be a backbencher in their parliamentary form of government. Interestingly enough, they're having an election in New Zealand, which is about 1,200 miles away, and in New Zealand they've got a liberal woman named Helen Clark, who is their prime minister, but she's been in power for, I think, 12 years. And so the idea is that she's not going to be reelected either, because the New Zealanders like to change their government right regularly, and 12 years is enough for anybody to serve. She served very effectively, I think. Someone once said politics are like underwear. The only way you keep them clean is to change them regularly. And I think that's probably the way both the Australians and the New Zealanders are feeling at this moment. So it'll be a new day. Kevin Rudd will not be a puppet of George Bush. He speaks Mandarin Chinese fluently, and the great trading today that goes on in the South Pacific is between Australia with its great mining and mineral rights and mineral rights, and China, which is an emerging economy of enormous power. And so the alliance is much more flowing between Australia and China than it is between Australia and the United States today.
Well, I have to laugh at your mention of changing the underwear. I once heard a progressive minister speak, and I'm sorry I cannot recall his name. He's based in Florida somewhere, and he made the remark that churches ought to be burned down every 20 years and just build them up from scratch because of, you know.
Rather radical solution. Some of them are so exquisitely beautiful that I would hate to see them destroyed, just like I hated to see the great shrine destroyed in Baghdad. I think it was the Sunni shrine that was destroyed by the Shia. It might have been a Shia shrine destroyed by the Sunni. I don't remember. But, you know, I hate to see any religious system spat upon or violated by somebody who doesn't share that point of view. There's something beautiful and wonderful about the human quest for God that I need to honor.
You have a good point, sir. And regarding what's going on with the Anglican Church in South Africa, and is this being mirrored in Australia, these threats to split off from the church? And by the way, my feeling about that is, you know, if you trim the dead wood out of a tree, then the tree grows, if you get my drift. What's going on with Australia / South Africa on those lines?
I don't find, you find Sydney, which is different from anything in Australia, is still deeply homophobic, and they're very much aligned with the African mentality. But I think you've got to be careful, because the chief spokesperson for gay rights in the Anglican Communion is Desmond Tutu, who is a South African, a member of the Xhosa tribe, a very black South African. So it's not monolithic. Desmond's successor as the Archbishop of Cape Town is a man named Jongo Kulu, who is also a very articulate, outspoken champion of the rights of gay and lesbian people. The Archbishop in the Anglican Church of Central Africa is a man named Kotso Makulu. He was also a champion for the rights of gay and lesbian people. What you're dealing with in Africa and the homophobia that's coming out of Africa is that these are by and large parts of the Anglican Communion that were missionized by the evangelical or fundamentalist wing of the Anglican Church, and they're doing the same thing that I used to do as a child. They're quoting the Bible to prove that homosexual people are somehow either sick or depraved, and they're simply not in touch with reality. You know, one African bishop told me that we don't have any homosexuals in Africa. That's an English disease, he said. Well, I've got a file of letters from gay and lesbian Africans who write me, and of course they're not public, because they would be probably murdered if they were public. So they're deeply closeted people, but they're certainly there, and you know, some of the people that are persecuting homosexuals are themselves self-hating homosexuals. I think you need always for that when you get this violent negativity toward gay and lesbian people. For the life of me, I don't understand why heterosexual people are scared of homosexual people. You know, I hear people say strange things like if we give homosexual people the right to marriage, it'll break up the institution of marriage. Where does that idea come from? Am I going to leave my wife because two gay or lesbian people can make public commitments that are blessed by their church and begin to live together in a sacred and holy relationship? I don't understand that argument at all. But that's nothing except fear-mongering, and they keep looking for some way to justify their fears and to try to say homosexuality will destroy the institution of marriage. They hope we'll get an awful lot of people so afraid of homosexuals that they'll vote to condemn them. Well, you know, when I was growing up in the South, we also said if you let segregation die, then all of our daughters will want to marry black people. I thought that was an interesting argument. You know, I think I live in a world where two people get married only because they choose to. So the great fear, I think, was that our daughters would all choose to marry black lovers.
And that says something about the sense of sexual inferiority that white males have compared to what they think are the virile black male figures. So I think our prejudices frequently reveal enormous things about ourselves that we don't seem to be conscious of.
Well, my feeling, and I've seen it reflected in your writings too, is the very fact that these things are being discussed actually means the argument is already won. As long as these things are not, yes, and we feel that about the LGBT community, the fact that nobody is going back in the closet and it's being discussed, but oh, how nice it would be if we would all just shut up. Nobody would violate anyone's comfort zone. But when you, once it begins being discussed, their arguments are just, they have no substance. And
that's absolutely correct. And that's because prejudices are enforced by definitions that are still operative. The definition about homosexual people that is still operative in prejudiced people is that people choose to be homosexual because they're either mentally sick and can't help it, that's the liberal position, or they're morally depraved and actually want to live an evil lifestyle, that's the conservative position. So as soon as that definition begins to wobble, you get the debate. Well, it never goes the other way. You know, as soon as you begin to debate the prejudice, it means the old definition isn't holding. And it was in 1988 that the Southern Baptist Convention was meeting, and they passed a resolution reaffirming their condemnation of homosexuality, and it won something like 95% to 5% of the vote. They reaffirmed their denunciation. Well, first of all, if you have to reaffirm an ancient prejudice, that means it isn't holding. You don't reaffirm it. You know, I don't know anybody that's reaffirming their conviction that murder is evil. You know, that just still assumes that murder is evil. So just the fact that they have to reaffirm it, and then the fact that 5% of the Southern Baptist delegates, or deputies, or whatever they were called, messengers, I think, 5% stood against the majority means that the majority isn't holding, even in the Southern Baptist tradition. Well, when I read that, I said the battle's over. Now, does that mean that gay people aren't going to be abused in the next 10 years? I'm sure they will be. But I want to tell you, there's nobody living that thinks that 10 years from now we're still going to be arguing about gay rights. We will have a society in which gay people are treated with absolute equality, and their sacred unions will be blessed, and they'll be made legal, and the rights of a human being to choose the partner with whom they want to live is going to be affirmed. It's going to be affirmed even in Mississippi. You know, the battle is over. It's just a matter of time. Yeah, even the gay bashing that Mr. Bush did in the campaign of 2000 and later in 2004, that doesn't make it today. You know, that even the Republican candidates, look who's leading the Republican race. It's Rudy Giuliani. When Rudy Giuliani and his wife, his second wife, separated, she wouldn't move out of Gracie Mansion, so he had to. And he moved into a condominium with a gay couple, and he lived with a gay couple for 6 months. Now, Rudy Giuliani can hardly claim to be anti-gay. And so here you have, he's the leading Republican candidate. The old prejudice has died a lot in the 8 years that George Bush has been in power. And so I don't think those old fears are going to carry much anymore. So I think we're in a new day. Now, again, that doesn't mean that homosexuality is going to, that homophobia is going to disappear tomorrow. But all the polls seem to indicate that if you're under 40 years of age, that you are not much bothered by homosexuality. That means 10 years from now, it'll be everybody under 50. 20 years from now, it'll be everybody under 60. And after a while, there's nobody left except a few nuts that, like Klansmen, you know, like Ku Klux Klansmen living today saying some of the things about black people that was commonplace back in the 1910s and 1920s. But today it sounds so bizarre and so sick that we recognize it for what it is. Now, I'll never forget being invited to a luncheon in the little town of Tarboro, North Carolina, where I served for 7 years as a priest. And I was invited by a young man who was the son of the man who was probably the most bigoted, prejudiced person I ever had to deal with, and who's now deceased. He was a good man, but this race thing was a real blind spot in him. And his son invited me to lunch. And the sole purpose of inviting me to lunch was to tell me that he wanted to apologize for the way his father had treated me, and he wanted me to know that he now believed that I was right and his father was wrong, and he's well-adjusted. Gay black people are in his church all the time now. When I was there, it would have been a major riot if black people, this was before desegregation came, and if a black person came into a white church, they'd probably be arrested. It's hard to believe that today, but that was probably the mentality there. So that, you know, you see the generations. If you can't adjust to a new reality, the fact is you're going to die. And we're all going to die. And that prejudice is going to die with you, and your children will adjust, and your grandchildren will adjust. So once a prejudice is debated in the public arena, and we've been debating homosexuality since Bill Clinton's election in 92, because he was the first one that said, yes, I'm going to do away with discrimination against homosexual people in the armed forces, created an enormous debate. But I'd like to tell you that today, I will bet you that every candidate running for president on the Republican or the Democratic side has a liaison on his staff to the gay community, because things have changed dramatically. I know all the Democrats do. I go to the Democratic conventions because I write a column every week, and so I go as a member of the press. I go to the Republican conventions too. But the fact is that when Al Gore was nominated to be president in 2000 and Joe Lieberman was nominated to be his vice president, in the speeches of both of them, they said, we've got to move against the kind of prejudice against homosexual people. That was public and out front in both of these people. And it's going on all over the world.
We had a guest recently. His name is Denny Meyer. He's with the American Veterans for Equal Rights. It's an organization of LGBT veterans who've served in various wars all the way back to World War II and the Gulf Wars and what have you. And I believe it was he who made the observation that never in the history of the world has there ever been a group of people who have advanced their civil rights in terms of marriage and acceptance in general, et cetera, until they had received equal treatment in the military. That always seems to precede it. I was not aware of it, but he did make that observation.
And yeah, I disagree with that. I think the church and the military are the two most homophobic institutions we've got in our society, and I don't think that's where change comes from. The military is a deeply patriarchal institution. They had a hard enough time adjusting to black soldiers. You know, that didn't come about until 1948 when Mr. Truman made an executive order. Then they had an equally hard time adjusting to females. I have a daughter who was a Marine for 9 years, a helicopter pilot, and she flew 3 tours of duty in the Iraq War. But I want to tell you that she was constantly being challenged by these male officers who felt that she had no place, and she had to be twice as good. She won their respect because she was good. But the military is, you know, that's a difficult institution to crack. But now, you know, you look at the soldiers in Iraq today. A significant number of them, including our officers, are Hispanic and black. There was no officer in an integrated unit before 1948. We had some black units with them, some black officers of black units, but they always had a white commander. We've come a long way in this century. So I don't think I'd want to wait until the military can solve the problem. I really do agree with Eric Fromm, who was a German-born American psychologist, who said nobody ever thinks their way into new ways of acting. You act your way into new ways of thinking. So I think
what we need
to do is to act and let the world react. And that's the way the consciousness of the people has changed.
Very well said. I should point out that we only have about 4 minutes left, and I'm going to try to sneak in one more question from the chat room, but in case we run out of time, I want to tell you have been an absolutely delightful guest. I realize we've only just barely scratched the surface. Someone of your depth, we could probably do 2 weeks of two-hour shows and still not cover it all.
Probably 4 years, yes, considerably.
No, you've been received with rapt attention, I assure you. And it's very kind of you to take some time out. I would love to contact you again in the future perhaps have you back.
Please
you're
do.
Always...
Just call my wife. She schedules everything I do.
Well, she's delightful, by the way. I had not spoken to you before this telephone, for this radio show, but I had spoken to your wife via several emails, and she's delightful and efficient and obviously your right-hand person. I don't know how you would...
I married well above myself. I recommend it to everybody.
With 200 speaking engagements a year, I can't see how you could possibly do without her. Just one quick question, if I can slip it in, if there's time. And the question is from the chat room, and it's how does one square Christianity with our propensity for war in the very region that that Jesus lived and died? What are your thoughts along those lines?
If you go back and read the Bible, you'll find that that's been going on since the dawn of time. Remember that the Jews, according to the biblical story, were slave people in Egypt. And they escaped Egypt and went on a marauding campaign to reclaim land that they said had been promised to their ancestors 600 years ago. Well, that's a pretty weak argument, I would say. 600 years is probably four generations, 100 for every century. 600 years would have been 24 generations. How many people want to make that kind of claim that 24 generations ago this piece of land was promised to me by God, to my ancestor? I think that's pretty weak. And so from that time on, they've been battling, the Jews against the Canaanites and the Philistines and the Babylonians and the Assyrians. Today their names are Persians and Iraqis and Arabs and Phoenicians and all that. But that's a warlike area. And the reason it's a warlike area is that civilization grew up between the Tigris and the Euphrates River in what is now Iraq and the Nile River Valley in what is now Egypt. And the Holy Land is the land over which they fought. These two great civilizations, Egypt and the Babylonians and the Persians and later the Macedonians, were all fighting over this piece of land. This is where the power was in the ancient world. Now, it's not where the power is today, but they've got a resource there called oil that everybody who has power needs desperately, whether you're Chinese or Indian or Japanese or English or American. Oil is what makes our economy go. And so it's still a vital part of the national interest of every nation in the world. And yet the three great Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, all grew up in that little tiny part of the world. Now Buddhism and Hinduism are Eastern. Hinduism is basically born in India, and Buddhism is sort of an offshoot of Hinduism. It's sort of Buddhism is to Hinduism what Protestantism is to the ancient Catholic traditions, an offshoot from the same root. But it's interesting to look at religion. But religion is always in the service of the tribe. Every religion is born in the service of the tribe. And the tribes are all warlike because the tribes are all fighting the battle of survival. If your tribe gets defeated, your God gets killed. So that, you know, God and your tribe are always working together. That's why in the early parts of the Bible, God is clearly on the side of the Jews, and God really hates Egyptians. That's why God sent plague after plague after plague on the Egyptians. The final plague was that God kills the firstborn in every Egyptian household. Then God opens up the Red Sea to let the children of Israel walk through on dry land. Then God closes the Red Sea to drown all the Egyptians. And then God is portrayed as rejoicing on the other side of the Red Sea that all the Egyptians are dead.
Well, that's
not a good view of God if you happen to be an Egyptian.
You're right. And I'm sorry, we are going to have to close on that. We're reaching the top of the hour, and we've got to intro the next show, and it's all computerized, et cetera.
Wonderful to be with you, and my best to your audience and all your chat rooms.
Thank you. I deeply appreciate your being with us, sir, and I'll send you a link to the archive tomorrow. There's an audio archive.
Thank you.
All right. Good evening, sir. And what a wonderful guest that was. Wow. Thank you, Lottie, for suggesting Bishop Spong. I want to tell you that coming up next will be the horn section. Myself and John Fox and Bob Kincaid will be joining you for a host roundtable, so to speak, or a tri-table. And as we reach the top of the hour, I'm just going to tell you we have some wonderful guests scheduled on Strictly Confidential the rest of the week. No time to tell you about them all now, but tomorrow night we have another ex-gay survivor. And here's Cynthia Manley reminding you too.
Ask any musician. The best music happens when the sheet music gets put aside and the gang just sits down and jams. Same thing here on The Horn. America's best liberal talk hosts free-forming together for an hour a night. Welcome to The Horn Section.